Next case on for oral argument this morning is State of Minnesota versus Marshall. Counsel, each of you will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel if you'd like to use that time for rebuttal. Please be mindful of the timing restrictions indicated in the lectern with a light and a clock that indicate what time you have remaining. I'm sure you're aware of this, but if not, there's a button in front of the in the lectern that allows you to raise or lower it to your height to match your own height for your convenience. Please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument. You may begin whenever you're ready.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Peter Dahlquist. I am the attorney for Joseph Marshall in this matter. Marshall stands before this court asking it to reverse his conviction for fifth-degree assault. He specifically asks this court to reverse because the district court erroneously admitted evidence regarding the identity, specifically through testimony of two officers at trial. This court has historically drawn a distinction between officer testimony that is permitted to show the context of the investigation versus testimony that is meant to identify a specific defendant or person as the assailant in a case. The testimony that historically has been more admissible is narration testimony to show multiple surveillance video and a person moving from place to place. The testimony that specifically has typically been inadmissible is more along the lines of, there's the defendant, he did it here, you can see that. It is that type of
That's not this case, right?
I think it is, Your Honor.
Based on what line in the testimony did they say that? He did it. I mean, where does it say that, Mr. Dahlquist?
Your Honor, if I go specifically to Officer Chapman's testimony,
okay.
And I anticipate the state is going to make an argument that this is more of a lack of a curative instruction type case, but if you go to his testimony at page 144, he identifies this. 145, he testifies that that in Exhibits 3 through 9, which are pictures.
Yeah, and the objection is sustained.
It is. And do you mind if I just skip forward?
Go ahead.
So I agree. This is a mixed bag where the defense attorney does object repeatedly to some of the identification. The court does sustain some identification. The court does overrule some of those. What I find troubling is the repeated testimony that's the defendant, he's right there, that's Marshall. And then the objection follows, and that statement repeatedly is kind of left hanging out there. So the court does not ever make a curative instruction to strike the evidence. The court never makes a curative instruction for the jury to disregard the evidence.
So, counsel, can we take the approximately five statements that you point to and parse them out by the ones that were objection overruled versus objection sustained? And as to the ones that were overruled, explain why that, in fact, was not allowable. Because it seems that the witnesses were testifying about their own perceptions. And when asked what they were basing the identification on, they talked about the similarity between the clothing and the physical description.
And I agree, Your Honor, that those are admissible. When it's, like, for example, page 138, where he says they have a working description based on a black male wearing black clothing with long dreads. That's admissible. That was objected to. It was overruled. Then when the officer says that he said he viewed in the surveillance video Marshall swinging some sort of object in an overhead motion that was consistent with the broken glass found on the scene, that was sustained. I do think that's objectionable. Part of my problem is that's a really specific statement that's just said to the jury, and I know it's objected to and sustained, but it's still there. The toothpaste is kind of out of the out of the tube.
So I think then you have to show prejudice, right?
Clearly.
So how was he prejudiced then? If the, you know, this evidence was, you know, they watched the video. Seems like it was pretty strong evidence that he was there. Where's the prejudice?
So I think you can look at a couple different things. I assume you want me to skip the rest of the instances, because I think those two are really emblematic of kind of the testimony as it goes through. But one thing is to note the surveillance video. And the surveillance video in particular that the jury watched on several occasions is of this assault. The surveillance video is down the street. There is a light post in the way. There are several trees in the way as well. Even the state in its closing admits that it's not a perfect video, that they would prefer to have a better look at this whole incident. The surveillance video is of three people. One is the victim. He ends up on the ground. One is the individual with black hair and long dreads, and one is the third individual. And you largely can't see the third individual because he's behind a tree. You can see him enter the scene. You can see him walk away. And the individuals come together, and you see the victim drop. And the officer narrates that this is what they're looking at. They're looking at Marshall reaching forward, reaching up, swinging, things of that nature, okay? Historically, this court has placed a lot of value. They've said officers' testimony is very persuasive. This dates back to, I think I saw a case from 1998, but the one that's often cited is Hoggett Vett, that officer testimony is very persuasive. This court has further said that that the court really prefers to see a limiting instruction. It's kind of like in Ali, which was a triple homicide case from 2014, where the officer said that they saw the defendant move from surveillance video to surveillance video to surveillance video. But in that case, they give a limiting instruction that the jury was supposed to form their own opinion based on their view of the evidence. And there's no guardrail in this case similar to Ali. There's no jury instruction that says that the jury has to form their own opinion. To be honest, the jury instructions are a little bit vague even in terms of how the jury is to treat this testimony that's been admitted versus suppressed regarding Chapman. So the jury, if I'm gonna be really specific about the jury instructions specifically say that on 241 it says that they've ruled on objections to certain exhibits. You must not concern yourself with the reasons for the ruling since they're controlled by the rules of evidence. It doesn't say to disregard my objections or evidence there, okay? The next page, 242, it says you're to disregard all evidence I have ordered stricken or I have told you to disregard. But again, during Chapman's testimony, there were objections and some were sustained, but the court never ordered that evidence stricken. And it never told the jury to disregard the evidence. So the jury's left in kind of a limbo.
And that was never requested, right?
No, I don't. I would concede that. That Marshall didn't make that request.
One reason we always hear, well, I didn't want to emphasize it. So, you know, how come that's not this case?
I agree. I've had that argument before as well. Where
I've probably made it to you.
I think you did, Your Honor. And I anticipate the state's going to make that argument that the district court shouldn't be required sua sponte to step in either during testimony. I'm not sure it holds quite as much in jury instructions, but definitely in testimony there's that argument that it's the trial strategy of the attorney. I don't think that's the case here because of the repeated objection to the same line of questioning. I think that would be more pertinent in a case where something slips out.
But why wouldn't it be more so the case? You don't want to highlight this for the jury. I'm just envisioning the case where the opposite occurred, where the judge steps in sua sponte and gives the instruction that you're asking, and the jury convicts, and the argument on appeal is the judge stepped in, the judge essentially highlighted for the jury the prejudicial information that we wanted to keep, you know, stepping into the lawyer's role. I mean, these you know, these are difficult questions in the middle of trial. What do we want to tell? You know, are we afraid we're going to tell the jury, pay no attention to the elephant in the room by pointing out that there's an elephant they should be ignoring? It's hard under a plain error. Your plain error argument is I think, your steepest one.
And Your Honor, I think it's, to be honest, I think it's a little bit of a mixed bag that whether or not it gets to plain error, I know that's the state's argument. I think in a case like this, where there's five references to the same thing, where it isn't the elephant in the room. I mean, everybody knows it. Well, it is the elephant in the room, but it's a really big elephant. Everybody knows that Chapman is trying to narrate this. He's trying to identify it. I would say in a case where something slips out, you don't want it highlighted. The defense attorney, that could be part of the strategy.
But if we're parsing those five instances and three of them are actually where the objection was overruled, fall into the category of allowable, witness perception, then we're really only talking about two instances.
I agree, but I do think to highlight what Justice Ross and Justice Connolly were saying.
No, they're upstairs.
I think, though, if you're just talking about whether or not this could be trial strategy or not, I think that the repeated instances show that it's not trial strategy for this attorney to let it in or to ignore it. He's trying to object repeatedly to this identification.
But trial strategy not to highlight. I think that's clearly the strategy is not to let this in at all. But then there's a second question with regard to the instruction. Okay, once it's in, boy, I wish it wasn't in, but it's here. Now what do we do with it? Do we spotlight it, or do we just argue based upon what we've got available to us?
And I think once it happens again, there's no reason to then avoid the topic.
And then, I mean, you know, what kind of instruction would you have asked for? Well, ladies and gentlemen, you know, in that series of objections that I sustained some and I overruled some, here's how I want you to parcel out. They can't say that the defendant did it, but they can say that he appears to match the suspect's description matched the description on the video. So keep those things in mind. You can, the latter is okay, the former is good. And I'm well aware that we always assume the judge's instructions are followed and understood, but I mean, come on. I mean, like, that I think would be even worse than not objecting at all.
I think if we're talking about two different things, Your Honor, if we're talking about in the real time, I think the judge should have just issued that it be stricken and the jury disregard it. Maybe if it was just once, not, but then once it happens repeatedly, that's where I think that's important.
When you say repeatedly, you mean twice?
Yes. But I mean, there's other testimony. I know some of it's admissible, but there's other testimony, and it's clear that the identity is the central issue in this case. But then I think if I just jump forward a little bit, Your Honor, to the end and the jury instructions there, that's where this court in Ali has said we prefer those guardrails, that an instruction is warranted where the jury is supposed to base their perception off of the review of the evidence, not off the opinion of the officer. I think those two things, I agree, absent that, it's hard to get into everything else, and I think it's reasonable to worry about highlighting a point that maybe the trial attorney wanted ignored. But I don't think that's the case here. And I think that simple jury instruction, or excuse me, the simple instruction to the jury to disregard and the instruction to the court reporter to strike from the record would have been warranted there, as it happened several times. If there's no other questions, I will yield back. I will ask this court to reverse and remand this matter based on those rulings and a lack of instruction given to the jury at the end.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And you will have 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jim Haas. I'm an assistant Olmsted County attorney, and I represent the state of Minnesota in this case. This court can affirm Mr. Marshall's conviction by applying a harmless error analysis. And in the limited time I have with the court this morning, I'd like to focus my attention on that aspect of our analysis. Without, you know, formally conceding or forfeiting the arguments I've made in my brief with respect to the errors themselves, I'd like to presume under the assumption, for the sake of argument, that some mistakes were made during the course of the testimony, maybe individually or cumulatively, and approach it then from just a harmless error analysis. And as we know, that an appellate court need not address the merits of the claimed error if the error is harmless, or under the plain error analysis if the errors did not affect the defendant's substantial rights, or if the claimed error did not seriously affect the fairness, integrity, and public reputation of the judicial proceedings. So there's sort of a four-pronged approach to that. We look at the manner in which the state presented the evidence. We look at whether the testimony was highly persuasive. Three, we look at whether the state used the testimony in closing argument. And four, we look to whether the defense effectively countered the testimony. There's kind of a mixed bag with respect to the manner in which this evidence came into the hearing. There was some occasions where the officer just sort of gratuitously blurted out and used the word the defendant instead of the word suspect, and some of those drew sustained objections. And those were less harmful. There were some aspects, again, where the officers were just sort of trying to describe the nature of the suspect as it bore on and Mr. Marshall, and I think there's been some concessions that some of that's, maybe not objectionable. The part I'm not crazy about is on pages 171 to 172 of the transcript, and this is a colloquy between Mr. Rochelt, the prosecutor, and Officer Alexander. You may recall Officer Alexander was dispatched to the scene and was given a description of the suspect, and he was there about 1/2 hour after the dispatch call. I think it was about 1:06 a.m. was when the kind of the call went out, and he detained Mr. Marshall at 1:36 a.m., so about a half hour later. He sees the suspect that matches the description. He detains Marshall and arrests him, and I presume takes him down back to, just across the river to the police department, where the dispatch room is in that building, and he, for himself, went back to the dispatch room and viewed the surveillance footage himself from these cameras, which cover much of downtown Rochester. Anyway, he looked at the surveillance footage and his own recollection of just detaining Marshall, and Mr. Rochelt asked him about that and asked him how confident he was that, this fellow he arrested, appears to be the person shown in the video. And he, in so many words, conveys to the jury that, I think that's the same guy, in so many words. And that, to me, is the gist of the defendant's argument here, that they're relating this opinion. But let's look at the second prong of this. Was it highly persuasive? I mean, look, it should come as no surprise to the jurors that these officers at least think that Mr. Marshall is the person shown in the video. Had the officers not mentioned any sort of opinion, the jury could clearly infer that. We know from Officer I'm blanking on his name. Alexander?
Chapman?
The second one.
Chapman?
Yeah, Alexander. We see his body camera video when he detains Marshall. The jury knows this guy's being detained and is a suspect, and it's pretty clear that he's now being prosecuted for it. So obviously they, in good faith, think he's the same guy. So the fact that they share that opinion should not really shock anybody. This isn't expert testimony, by the way. This isn't someone that says, I have particular expertise in facial recognition, and I'm giving an opinion they're the same guy. It's the officer saying, I looked at the video. I remember arresting this guy. I think I got the suspect.
Well, that's not your characterization of the testimony just now would be, I think, regarding the overruled objections, not the sustained objections.
Correct. Correct. The characterization I'm talking about on 171, 172 was objected to and overruled and allowed.
Right. I think the issue is whether there was prejudice that results from the sustained objection.
And so that's what I'm sort of, I guess one of my points in this, was it persuasive, is that I think it's evident from the actions taken by the officers that they at least in good faith think he is that person. He was detained and arrested, and they know that. So does it really move the ball ahead?
Well, that's a little different. I mean, there's a difference between asking the officer or the officer testifying, you know, in good faith, I believe that's the person because, you know, the dreadlocks, the clothing. But that's not what's objected to. I think what's objected to is the definitive statement that that's the guy. The defendant is the one. And I think I'm a jury might infer not just that the officer is basing that on the characteristics that were within the overruled objections, but that the officer, as a police officer, has some other knowledge that the jury's unaware of that makes the identification much more persuasive for the officer to assert it than just leaving it to the jury to determine whether the one in the video is actually the defendant.
And my liberties of the record maybe are not the best. The exact quote from after the objection, Officer Alexander stated, and I quote, "The suspect that we were attempting to locate that was described was the person I located and detained." So that's what was said. And this court can balance the prejudicial impact of that. I would suggest that the officer's attempting to explain that, yeah, he matched that description. I would note as well in this regard on appeal, Marshall is not claiming that the evidence is insufficient. And, you know, we don't have to wrestle with that, but we have here a surveillance video. We have very clear body camera from Officer Alexander showing exactly what Mr. Marshall looked like 30 minutes after the assault and in the immediate vicinity of where the victim was found and where the assault occurred. I mean, it's on the same block. It's right there. So the jury can see it for themselves. I'll come back to that when you look at the fourth prong. I'd like to move on to these other two factors. The third is whether the state used this testimony in closing argument, and it did not. Nowhere in Mr. Roschel's closing argument does he credit the opinions or beliefs of the officers that's the same person. In fact, to the opposite, Mr. Roschel held up exhibits side by side, and he actually played the exhibits to let the jury see for themselves. And the fourth prong is whether the defense effectively countered the testimony. And Mr. Zurich, I think very effectively in his closing argument, addressed that. This is exactly what we quoted on page 271 of the transcript. He says, "You know who accuses Mr. Marshall? Officer Chapman. And Officer Chapman viewed the same surveillance video that we all saw here and then decided that was reliable enough information to arrest Mr. Marshall later that night. I must remind you that an arrest in and of itself is not evidence of guilt. Law enforcement, the officers that testified, they do not decide the facts. You do. That's your job. Just because an officer gets up there and testifies that, yep, that's him, you have to consider that yourself and determine whether or not that's believable." And I think that's a pretty effective counter-argument. In other words, look, I don't blame the officers. They in good faith see someone that looks, you know, like the guy. I can't blame them. But he's not the guy. There could be someone else that matches that description. There's a couple of cases that were cited in the brief, some non-published decisions that I think are distinguishable, and I think they play into this conversation. One was the Grunig case. It was an unpublished case, and there was an officer, Earl. Apparently, this offense was captured on some surveillance video. There's not real clear what it was. But this officer obtained Grunig's driver's license and looked at his picture, and then Officer Earl looked at the surveillance video. And Earl testified, "Look, I looked at the driver's license, I looked at the video, I think that's Grunig." The difference was the state never introduced the driver's license into the record. They based it solely on Officer Earl's testimony that I looked at the driver's license picture, I looked at the video, that's Grunig. And that is not our fact pattern here. And this court reversed and allowed a new trial there on those facts, but I think it's quite distinguishable. The other case, another case cited is an unpublished case of Turner. That's more recent. That was a second-degree murder case, and apparently the part of this was captured on some form of surveillance video. But there was a number of, and this court ultimately reversed and granted a new trial, and part of the issue was some identification testimony, but that wasn't all. There was a number of other errors. One of the more concerning was there was a witness, a fellow named Corey Byrd, who was interviewed by this Sergeant Sukta, one of the investigators. And Byrd apparently admitted to Sergeant Sukta, or stated that Turner was the killer. He basically agreed with Sukta, saying, yeah, I saw Turner kill him. Well, Byrd didn't testify, and that hearsay exception came into the record. Pretty probative and powerful evidence. And this court found that that evidence should not come in. Well, that's a pretty strong error. Well, commingled with that was another statement by Sergeant Sukta, who gave a permissible narrative of the surveillance video. And it was okay for Sukta to describe the narrative to the jury of who's going here, I watched this particular person and they never left the camera, that sort of thing. But in that context, Sergeant Sukta went too far when he referred to Turner as the fatal shooter. Throw in some examples of prosecutorial misconduct where the prosecutor asked the jurors to put themselves in Turner's shoes and insinuated that Turner was in a gang and improperly suggested Turner was on drugs. You put all those cumulative errors together, and this court remanded for a new trial. So there is an identification error commingled with it, but again, I suggest that Turner's distinguishable just because of the cumulative nature of those.
So, counsel, should the district court have provided a curative instruction, and what sort of is the line then between what the Supreme Court held in the State versus Washington case, where they said the district court should not interfere with trial strategy of the defendant, and when actually there is something that's occurring? I mean, opposing counsel pointed out maybe some of these objections that were overruled were not, but clearly the counsel was at the trial level was trying to prevent identification information from coming in. So from that perspective, with these two that were overruled, why shouldn't the district court have stepped in?
Well, I'll tell you, if I was the prosecutor trying that case, what I think I might have done is suggested to the district court, you know, Your Honor, we've had a number of different statements, some objected to, some not. Maybe the court ought to provide a curative instruction so that I don't have to deal with this issue on appeal. That wasn't done. But I think the discussion we had before about the tactical nature of district courts entering the fray, as I said in my brief, is very spot on. What's the district court to say? Hold on, jurors. You know those juicy details that you heard right before I sustained the objection? Yeah, forget about those. Just forget you never heard those.
What about a district court judge stepping in, sidebar with counsel, and saying, look, I don't want to wade into this, but should we have a curative instruction?
I think that would be good practice, Your Honor.
Why wouldn't that be required practice? In other words, why wouldn't it be an abuse of discretion for the district court not to allow the parties to put on the record the issue that we're flagging, which is this really a matter of strategy or just dropping the ball?
Well, I think there's a distinction between best practices and abuse of discretion. I wouldn't go so far as to say the judge has to stop everything. I mean, look,
it doesn't have to be stop everything. We're talking about a curative instruction. It could be after the fact.
Well, again, I agree. I think that probably would be prudent for jurists to do that.
But the question is it error for the judge not to do that?
I don't think it is. I don't think it's reversible error for the district court to fail to inquire of the parties. I think we expect that the trial lawyers know their case, and these lawyers weren't shy. I mean, you can read the record. There was quite a bit of engagement by Mr. Zurich about objecting to things. This wasn't the lawyer that just sat down and let things go by. And I think if he felt the need to do that, he could have done that. And as we've discussed before, there's a lot of good. Oh, I'm so sorry. I realize my time is up. I see
you can
my
finish your flashing.
To answer the court's question, I guess, in summary, I think it would be good practice for district courts to inquire the parties if they wish to have a curative instruction and how it would be fashioned. But I would suggest the failure to do so is not reversible error.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Counsel for appellant.
I just have a few things. I wanted to address just a few things that Mr. Haas brought up. One, I think we're talking about a little bit regarding a jury instruction immediately upon when something happens and whether or not the defense counsel should make a motion or request. The second piece is whether or not the court should have ordered it stricken. And I'm not sure that the defense counsel has the same obligation to make that motion. I think that's the court's responsibility. And I think that's distinguishable from the jury instruction. Mr. Haas also brought up the non-precedential opinion in Turner. I actually think Turner, there's one notable part about Turner that has bearing on this case. There's several notable parts, but one that really is that this court found it noteworthy that the district court gave a cautionary instruction in Turner regarding the officer's observations and the officer's opinion evidence. That's where I think the district court erred here, and that's why I think it's reversible. There are some similarities as well. The Turner surveillance video was described as poor, grainy, and the shooter was identified by clothing. This video wasn't particularly graining, but it was obstructed, and it's not perfect. There's not perfect clarity.
I'm trying to envision a curative instruction. I'm wondering if this is something that would have been sufficient in your mind. If the judge would have said to the jury, "Look, you heard an officer identify the defendant as the suspect in the video, and you heard me overrule, or you heard me sustain the objection to that. I'm advising you now that the officer was basing that identification of the defendant only on the clothing and the physical description of the individual that was in the video. Would that have been sufficient?"
I think there needs to be a cautionary additional instruction that says you are to consider your view of the evidence regarding our identity.
Let's assume the district court would have said that. You get to decide identity, not the officers.
Yeah, I think the problem is adding some gravitas to the officer's testimony. That's where I would, I agree. You could say his testimony, I'm thinking off the top of my head here, but his testimony was based off observations. It's his opinion. You should form your own opinion.
Right.
Yeah, something along that those
so
lines.
So then why wasn't Officer Chapman's follow-up sufficient? Officer Chapman was then asked specifically, how are you identifying that? And Officer Chapman says, based off the clothing and physical description of the individual. It sounds like Officer Chapman was giving the curative instruction that you think, at least in part, would have been helpful or maybe even sufficient.
I think the caution is really the important part, is to say that's what he viewed. He viewed a description. Then to make that leap that it's automatically the same person, that's where the jury needs to look and see.
Would you agree, at least for the sake of our analysis of prejudice, that we have to consider the officer's, whatever you want to call it, modification, clarification, when asked, how are you identifying? And the officer says, it's based off the clothing and physical description.
I think it's fair to consider his testimony as a whole. Yep, I think, does that answer? I think, I'd say yes.
It partly answers.
Yeah,
it's kind of a sidestep, actually.
I'm sorry. Yes, it's fair to question, to consider that, just as I think it's fair to consider the testimony that was objected to and sustained and was heard by the jury. I think both should be considered. I didn't mean to be evasive. That was my point.
I'm only kidding, too.
Yeah.
Partly it's your job to be evasive.
And I just wanted to highlight two additional things. Well, really one. Mr. Haas brought up the fact that the defense didn't raise sufficiency of evidence. Strategically, the defense can raise whichever argument they find fit. I don't think it's necessarily a concession one way or the other if we don't.
Particularly since sufficiency of the evidence is 99% of the time a dead loser.
I agree. And so just because it's not argued... Yes. Just because it's not argued doesn't mean that there wasn't harmless error. So thank you. I appreciate your time, Your Honors.
And thank you. We appreciate your time and your briefing and your argument. Very helpful to us. We appreciate it. The matter is submitted. We will issue our opinion within the statutory period. Thank you. Have a good rest of your morning. Now,
nice job.
Court's going to be in temporary recess while we reconstitute the panel.